Hello, I'm Daniel Weiss, your host, and you are listening to my podcast. If you are new to this podcast, my aim is to give you the insight so you learn how to master your mind and optimize your health for the peak performance that is sustainable. Okay, Bob, so officially I'm recording right now.
Okay.
And perfectly, thank you once more for accepting my invitation and sharing your time with me and with the listeners.
Absolutely.
And hopefully to provide some answers how people like endurance athletes, OCR athletes, or people in general actually can benefit from your specialization, which is like metabolic efficiency training, right?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah, and you have extensive knowledge in this aspect with training with triathletes, and this is why I also asked you to join me.
Yes.
And actually, can you tell us more about that? Like, what is it that you actually do?
Yeah, so I I am a sport dietitian, also a coach, a professional USA triathlon certified coach. So I work with a lot of triathletes, ultra runners, ultra cyclist, OCR athletes, because I'm a turned OCR athlete a few years ago. So mostly sport dietitian, like I said, endurance coach. I'm an author. I do a lot of presentations and mentor new coaches and new sport dietitians. But I'm in Colorado in the United States, and you know I've been doing this since, boy, for a long time. This is my 23rd or 24th year doing this now, and I coined and created the concepts of both nutrition periodization and also metabolic efficiency training in the early 2000s. So definitely have a little specialty in this area, and I'll tell you, you know, I've got schooling. I've got 3 college degrees in exercise science, physiology, and then food science and human nutrition, and I'm really eager, looking forward to our conversation, especially as the obstacle course, community, because like I said, I just started getting into this a few years ago and just absolutely love that style of training and racing, and so yes, endurance athletes and OCR athletes, I think we can relate to all of them here.
Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah. How did you actually get to this? Got to this field of studies?
You know, I grew up an athlete, so I grew up a soccer player in the United States, and have just been always just fascinated with performance, right, and what the human body could do. And uh-huh. You know, towards the end of high school, I really had no clue what I wanted to do in terms of college, and you know, took a year off and worked a little bit and just explored some interest. And you know, I went into college kind of undeclared, didn't really know exactly what I wanted to do. I just knew I love the way the human body worked, and the college I attended here in Colorado, Colorado State University, had a sports medicine program, and I figured, oh, well, you know, if it has sports in it, it must be interesting. So I kind of started there, and once I began my studies, I just became so just enamored and just amazed with the physiology and the biochemistry and metabolism and just everything, and kind of added onto that the nutrition piece a little bit later when I went back to graduate school, and it just kind of took me from there. So I think, you know, growing up as an athlete kind of shaped my entire career in schooling.
That's amazing. How did you then transition, or what made you to transition to OCR?
Oh, that was interesting. So I grew up a soccer player, you know, so very stop and go, anaerobic, sprinting, you know, not a lot of heavy lifting, obviously, but there wasn't a huge aerobic component. I mean, obviously you need to be aerobically fit to be a soccer player, but you know, we didn't really train aerobically. And then I moved, you know, I was doing my undergraduate in college, and I got dared by a friend of mine to do a triathlon. You know, it was on campus and it was a short distance, and I had no idea. This was back in the mid 90s, and I had no idea what a triathlon was, right? So I, you know, and I kind of knew how to swim. I had a mountain bike, but I knew how to run for sure, right, as a soccer player. So I did it, and you know, no success story here. I kind of, you know, I finished almost dead last, but it was that competitiveness, like, wow, I want to be better at this. So I kind of went.
What distance was that?
This was a sprint distance. Oh. Yeah, so very, very short distance. You know, a swim in the pool, and I actually biked on my mountain bike because I didn't have a road bike yet, and just got so hooked with triathlon that I started training for triathlon, and that was kind of a hard process for me because I came from a soccer background and I love sprinting so much. So I, you know, I did endurance racing for years and years, and you know, decades really. And then, you know, what was it about OCR? My first OCR race was actually in 2015, Lake Tahoe World Championships, you know, just kind of signed up and went and didn't, I had no idea what I was getting into, but living in Colorado, you know, I also came, you know, throughout my triathlon experience, I've done Ironman races and marathons, but I actually transitioned mm-hmm. into ultra running. So I've done, you know, the Leadville 100, both running and mountain biking. So I love trail running. So I figured, oh, this is in Lake Tahoe, it's on a trail, I'll just go and run, right? And you know, I kind of train for the obstacles, more like, you know, oh, I'll do some push-ups and I'll do some burpees. I had no idea the level of complexity that I should have trained for those obstacles though, right? So I would pass people like crazy running, right? Because that was one of my specialties. But once we got to the obstacles, boy, I think I must have done 120, maybe 150, 180, somewhere around there, burpees that day. That was my first introduction to OCR. So kind of like my first triathlon, after that finish, I was very humbled and I said, wow, you know what? I'm going to actually train for my next OCR. So then I did, you know, the following year, I did a sprint and then a super and then the beast. I did the beast at Lake Tahoe the first year and then the beast the next year again uh-huh. and went to Lake Tahoe. And this year I actually did. So I've been doing this for a few years now and gotten smarter with my training, with my nutrition. This year in August, we have a Spartan race in Breckenridge, which is just a couple hours away from me up in the mountains. You know, 9,600 feet was the starting elevation. We go up to 11,000. My first time doing the Ultra Beast. So I did two laps of this, 31 miles. And, you know, I raced the open category because I wasn't quite sure what to expect. And, uh-huh. you know, came in first in my category with that. So I, you know, I'm thinking, you know what? I think I'm getting closer to understanding the sport.
That's great.
Yeah, but it kind of brings back my soccer roots of sure. being able to sprint and do very anaerobic, powerful movements. And that's what I love. So that's what I love about OCR is the blend of aerobic and anaerobic.
Yeah, and that's, I think, is also a very interesting topic because, like, when we are speaking about endurance sports, like, let's say, ultra marathoners, they tend to have this kind of steady yes. state or steady pace. And when you come to, well, maybe even ultra running, but not yeah. more like trail running, there is this variation of the speed. And in races like Spartan Race or OCR, it's just all over the place.
It's all, yeah, and you can't even, you don't know because a lot of these races, I mean, you might look at a map, but you don't know exactly where these obstacles are going to fall and, you know, what's going to actually happen at these obstacles. And that's, it's actually quite a challenge from a nutrition perspective. Yeah. And that's one thing that I started dialing in myself and then helping other OCR athletes because it is, it's night and day. It's not, you know, it's not something like powerlifting and it's not something like just, you know, running a marathon, right? It's kind of a blend, but it's very special also.
Yeah, it's in the end, the combination of all the systems, like, and finding the balance for the person.
Exactly.
And yeah. this is actually absolutely what fascinates me about it as well, because there is the same kind or level of complexity from the point of nutrition, but also from the point of training. And yeah, like you mentioned,
yes.
you can be a great runner, but then fail obstacles and then be chasing with people who
yeah.
didn't fail.
yeah,
that's kind of my story as well. And
yeah, is it? Yeah, yeah.
So okay, so how does your nutrition background and all of that play into that?
Yeah,
especially when it comes to like nutrition periodization, for example.
Right. Right. Yeah. So this is, it's a great feed in because, you know, one thing that I think a lot of people miss is they train differently, right? Call it an OCR race or anything. And they train differently throughout the year, right? They might have times of high intensity, high volume, low intensity, low volume, whatever, you know, they might be doing more anaerobic or less aerobic or more aerobic, right? So they fluctuate their training, but you know, the whole concept of nutrition periodization really centers on allowing nutrition to support the variations of training, right? So if you have highs and lows in training, your daily nutrition plan should actually support that. So there will be times where athletes will need more carbohydrate or more protein or more fat or less of one of the macronutrients. Mm-hmm. And that's really the concept of nutrition periodization, is to work nutrition in to basically support the physical periodization and the physical energy expenditure that you're going through. So I get very minute with some athletes I work with, and we go on a daily basis and try to understand, you know, the physical training that they're doing, how they should be fed from a nutrition periodization standpoint. So as an example, you know, maybe one day I'm doing a lot of OCR training, but then the next day maybe I'm just going for a nice easy trail run that I'm keeping, you know, intensity low, heart rate low, all aerobic based. Mm-hmm. But the day previous was anaerobic based. So the whole concept of nutrition periodization fits in nicely when individuals and athletes just they realize that, wow, I just need to eat to support my training, and so my training is as best as I can make it. So it is actually very easy to explain. It's a little bit harder to do because we as humans usually want to follow the same diet pattern, yeah. Right? We don't want to maybe one day reduce our carbs or increase our fat or protein, right? We always kind of want to keep it on the straight and narrow. And that's probably the easiest part is to talk about it, but the hardest part is actually to implement it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and as you are speaking, like, yep. what is the benefit of periodizing your nutrition in that perspective? Like you mentioned.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I think one of the key things is if someone is concerned with their weight or their body composition, by periodizing nutrition to support physical training, you can actually support better or more successful weight loss and body composition changes. Because, you know, as an example, if I'm in a training time of my year where maybe I did my last OCR race, I'm taking a couple weeks off, you know, if I'm eating a lot of carbohydrate, I'm most likely going to overeat, right? And that's a time where I'm going to gain weight and gain body composition. Mm-hmm. Versus maybe another time where if I'm just starting to train again, you know, we kind of ease in the process of feeding carbohydrate and making sure protein and fat is appropriate. So not only from a body composition and a body weight standpoint, but we're also looking at health benefits, right? So we know that, you know, if certain people overeat based on their genetic history of disease, they will they'll be more susceptible to things like metabolic syndrome, diabetes, other health concerns. It could be high blood lipids, high triglyceride levels, so a lot of things, and even kicking hormones out of whack at times. So very important, not only from a performance standpoint, but also a health standpoint. I mean, the performance standpoint is usually providing your body enough energy to not only be able to do the workouts and the training, but also recover successfully, right? The health is more body weight, body composition, sleep patterns, and, mm-hmm. and really looking at those health biomarkers.
Yeah, but definitely also health influences the performance. It's not like separate.
Absolutely. Yep. You can't perform if you're not healthy. That's what I always tell athletes.
Yeah. So then, as you also already mentioned, like, we like to stick to maybe some kind of diet that is like our baseline, or we don't like to have these fluctuations because maybe it's like,
yep,
too much to think about, at least in the beginning.
Exactly.
And
yep. It's easy. We just want a quote unquote diet to follow because it's easy. Yeah. You know, people don't want to take shortcuts.
Yes. Yeah. So for example, if I'm a person now training, we are reaching basically end of the season, and then there will be like off season and maybe like building the base if we are having like periodization in the training at all, and that's when you do mostly like aerobic stuff, right? So basically, as I understand,
you should support the system by increasing your fat intake.
Right. Yep. And there's kind of a fine line there, right? And obviously it depends on the person. I mean, when I work with athletes, I try to get blood work on them and, you know, just make sure that we're taking care of looking at all aspects, right? In terms of their health history, medical history, genetic history. But yeah, to your point. So when you're not training as much really, and you're doing more aerobic exercise even, or you just kind of get into it, you do most individuals do very well at reducing carbohydrates, increasing fat, and then protein. You know, I always tell people, once we find where your protein should be, we don't really need to move it that much, right? It's really fluctuating the carbohydrate and the fat more than fluctuating the protein. But yes, to your point, with the aerobic, and then as you build into your season, or even if you start doing more OCR training or high intensity training, those are actually the days where we look at feeding a little bit more carbohydrate and feeding a little bit less fat. So you could go through this, you know, some people call it fat adaptation. I call it metabolic efficiency, where you're actually teaching your body to utilize more fat as energy. We're going through that process at certain points of the year where it's not going to sacrifice your training. It'll actually augment or improve your training status.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So basically, yes, like you mentioned, fat adaptation and or metabolic efficiency.
Yeah.
And what if you are just somebody who just eats, let's say, still about, I mean, throughout the year, 50-60%, let's say 60%, carbohydrate diet, and I mean, we are not speaking like fast absorbed carbohydrates that spike insulin much, but slower digesting, like whole foods and and such.
Yeah, and that's, you know, what I found is there are some individuals out there that can pull that off because they have the genetic ability to not have high cholesterol, high triglycerides, high LDL, low HDL. So some people, but it's very few. It's probably less than 5% of the people I've ever worked with actually have the good genes to be able to pull that off and not gain weight, not gain, actually very few. And one thing, you know, just to mention, as we go through the aging continuum, usually happens around, you know, I would say between 35, 36 to 40 years old, things start happening from a biological standpoint. Hormones start shifting significantly in both males and females, which actually increases the body's I don't want to say ability, but susceptibility to gain weight. So at a certain age, and in kind of the situation you talked about, the, you know, younger individuals can probably get away with a little bit higher carb diet throughout the entire year, right? But as they start aging, they're going to start to realize very quickly that, you know, they're gaining weight. They've got a little bit more belly fat or fat on their hips if they're females typically. Things start changing. So that's why I like to start, you know, getting into the nutrition periodization early on to teach individuals, even if they're younger, to teach them that, you know, we may be able to do this right now, but we still want to be able to alter your nutrition to get ready for the future. And I'll tell you this, I mean, you know, the higher carb diets, usually, depending on what type of carbohydrates you're eating, like you were saying, sometimes can actually increase inflammation in your body, which could actually slow the recovery from training. And as you well know, OCR training, when done correctly, is pretty difficult, right? It will actually take a toll on your body. So you want to be able to recover quickly. And one way to do that is really to periodize your macronutrients.
Yeah, so based on what you were saying, actually, I feel like I fall into that category of the 5%.
Yeah. You're one of those lucky ones, huh?
At least for now, but yeah. Also, as you mentioned, like over the years, well, things might change. At the same time, I feel like, it's more like that as we age. Also, as I know that our capacity to prefer different type of fuel, that means like we get worse at using the carbohydrates,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yep. Because we come, you
we
know,
get better at.
Yeah, through aging too, and there's a lot of different factors here, but through aging too, you can become more tolerant or intolerant to carbohydrates, right? So your body just doesn't process them as well as it used to. And that's, you know, due to different enzyme activity. Maybe something is happening at the mitochondrial level, you know, as you age, and certainly genetics plays a role in this. But yeah, to your point, it does take its toll. You know, that aging continuum definitely takes its toll.
Yeah, and at the same time, actually also our ability to use and break down the proteins,
yes,
also is hindered. So we need to increase this consumption.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's, you know, and that's kind of goes back to that's the beauty of periodizing your nutrition and just kind of understanding the body more. You know, I think when individuals first get into sport or different sports, you know, there's a learning process in knowing how your body is going to respond, not only physically, but also from a nutrition standpoint. So that's when, you know, usually there's a little bit of a learning curve. And like, I remember when I got into OCR training, you know, I was kind of that fat adapted, metabolically efficient, and I still am, but I didn't realize how much more carbohydrates I had to feed, not only in my OCR training, but during competition, because normally during like running races, you know, trail races, I would hardly take in, you know, I would take in very minimal calories, because it was more like you said earlier, it was more aerobically based, you know, and I was very, very good at burning fat. But when I got to the OCR races, I noticed that, well, yeah, even though I'm running, number one, you know, you want to do well, so you're not running aerobically anymore. You're trying to pass people, keep up with people. But I also noticed that I, you know, my intensity or my heart rate would spike at these obstacles, which would facilitate a higher rate of glycogen depletion or carbohydrate utilization. And I actually had to change my nutrition strategy quite a bit when going into OCR and kind of favoring more carbohydrates during certain days of training, and obviously during the races themselves.
Okay, so I think it's also important to basically define for people, because not everybody knows what it can mean to be fat adapted or metabolically efficient, because I also think and see that people throw this like fat adaptation, you know, like a buzzword, and don't really understand what it means.
Right. Yep. So you want me to explain that? Sure.
Yes, okay. Please.
Yeah. So basically, our body stores fat and carbohydrate, right? Our bodies store, depending on the person, in upwards of 60,000-70,000 calories worth of fat, whereas the typical female might store about 1,200 to 1,400 calories as carbohydrate. Typical male, usually around 1,500 to 2,000 calories from carbohydrates. So we know we've got stores of carbs and fat, but we know we have a lot more stores of fat. So the onus is on us, and this is what led me to develop this concept, you know, over 15, 16 years ago, is asking the question, is it possible to teach our body to burn more fat or more carbs through dietary approaches? And that's what was never known in the past. It was known, you know, in the 50s and the 60s, 1950s, 1960s, that if you train aerobically, you will burn more fat, but no research was done on dietary manipulations. So what I did was I approached it from the dietary standpoint and said, okay, if we manipulate carbs and fat and protein going into the body, can I manipulate the way the body burns fat or burns carbohydrates? So the easiest way to explain this is, if you eat a higher carbohydrate diet, it is most likely you will be more of a carbohydrate burner or a sugar burner, if you will, right? And if we control carbohydrates, which means if we lower them a little bit, and I'm not talking ketosis, but I'm just talking a lower amount of carbs, but a higher amount of fat and a little bit more higher or moderate amount of protein, if we can control blood sugar, we'll actually control our body's ability to turn on our fat burning response. So you can actually train the body to burn more fat or more carbohydrate through metabolic efficiency, through just daily nutrition. And there's some biochemistry there too, because the main concept of metabolic efficiency is to control blood sugar through food. If you control your blood sugar and you don't have those serious spikes, you won't have significant spikes of insulin, which means that your body will be in a more fat burning state than a carbohydrate burning state. So there's some science biochemistry behind it that I won't bore you with, but there, you know, just so, you know, your listeners understand, this isn't a made up topic. Like this is decades and decades of biochemistry kind of coming together that I've used, and I put it in a model that actually changes the nutrition, the daily nutrition plan, to favor either or, you know, carbohydrate or fat burning. And like I said with my introduction to OCR, I actually had some days that I had to teach my body to utilize more carbohydrate due to my training status being more anaerobic based.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, so basically, when we are metabolically efficient, to sum it up, is like about controlling the blood sugar. And
right, exactly.
And how can a person, now there is a person listening to it, how can they test if they are or what is their level of metabolic efficiency?
That's a very good question. If you want the best quantitative testing, you need to find a performance center or individual that actually has a metabolic cart. And there's a specific protocol that I've actually developed called, you know, it's basically just the metabolic efficiency testing protocol, and it's done on a treadmill or a bicycle, and it's a submaximal test. It's you know, I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard of VO2 max testing before. VO2 max testing is more of a performance test that takes about 8 to 12 minutes. A metabolic efficiency test is a submaximal test where we're looking at nutritional assessment rather than really a performance assessment. Uh-huh. And it's a submaximal test. It usually takes about 20 to 40 minutes depending on the individual. But it's very much an easier test to do. Now, that said, I know a lot of your listeners are like, well, wait a second, what if I can't get the test done? There's not a quantitative way to know how metabolically efficient you are if you don't have the testing done with a metabolic cart with a qualified individual. And I will say this, I've actually developed also a metabolic efficiency training specialist certification, which just means this: there's about 70 individuals across the US and a couple international that are trained in metabolic efficiency. Some of them actually do the testing, and in the United States there's a decent amount of testing centers that I can point people to if they want the test done. I don't know anyone in your area personally, but we can certainly, you know, look for that. But aside from the testing, you can, you know, there's some guesses you can make. I mean, the easiest one is, hey, you know, if you are actively losing weight or body composition, it might be feasible that you are more in a fat adaptation or metabolically efficient state, possibly, unless you're just going crazy with reducing your calories and not moving around your carbs, protein, or fat. The other way to know, one of the easier ways to know, is actually the reduction during training. So if I'm going to go out for a trail run and maybe I normally consume, I don't know, 200 calories an hour, if through a couple of weeks or a couple of months, if I start doing the same run, same duration, same intensity, but I now require 150 calories per hour, that's the body's adaptation response in saying, wow, I'm improving my body's ability to burn fat, therefore I need fewer calories during my training.
So basically what you are saying is that you can improve your metabolic efficiency by training besides nutrition.
Yes. So, well, and here's the thing: you can adapt your body to be more metabolically efficient. The equation that I've set out, and I teach people through doing this for, you know, 13, 14, 15 years, is 75% of developing your body's ability to burn fat better, this metabolic efficiency, is through nutrition changes. 25% is through physical exercise changes, and that is mostly aerobic exercise. So back in the days, we only knew that aerobic exercise improved the body's ability to burn fat. Nowadays, we know that the nutrition component is actually much more powerful than the aerobic exercise component. And, you know, a great example of this is when I'm working with an athlete, I get to the point of saying, it doesn't matter what your training looks like right now. If you're doing a lot of anaerobic, so be it. All I want you to do is follow the nutrition plan, because that will lead us to the changes that they want.
Yeah, definitely. But also, as you were speaking about, or answering the question about the testing, it came to my mind, like, the ways how a person can test it on their own without like having specific quantifying results is like maybe going or do this kind of intermittent fasting like 18 to 24 hours and see how they respond to that.
It's a decent way to do it also.
Yeah, so basically a person who has a good ability to burn fat or switch to fat oxidation should have no problem with this, with going one day without.
Exactly. And even throughout the day, you know, I find people who are more fat adapted or metabolically efficient, they're able to prolong the times in between meals, right? So maybe they don't get hungry every 2 hours, but they get hungry every 4 or 5 hours, right? That's a great sign of being more fat adapted.
Okay. Yes, it also makes sense. Actually, I will make an example from my perspective or from my life. Like I eat three meals a day.
Okay.
And that's like 6 hours apart from each other, approximately, without going really hungry. Yes.
Do you do any intermittent fasting?
I wouldn't say so. Basically, I have like breakfast, lunch, and dinner. That's it.
Okay. Yeah.
So yeah, and training in between, even if I train like 2-3 times a day.
Yes.
Let's say. And yes, also as we were speaking about the exercises, I've noticed that during the, I started running like in the morning before breakfast.
Yeah.
And yeah, at the same heart rate, my performance has been improving. So that's also nice.
Now, are you in a stage of your training where you're still competing, or are you more in an off season right now?
Now I had like a easy week, and now I will start basically off season, but I'm leaning into it.
Gotcha.
So no competitions in near future.
Right. And I think that's an important thing for your listeners to remember is, and that's why I asked that people can start saying, oh yeah, I have to look at what stage of training or what cycle of training I'm in first, because that is going to somewhat dictate how you're going to eat. You know, are you going to do intermittent fasting? Are you going to, you know, you're going to lower your carbohydrates or increase your carbohydrates and fat and protein? So that's a good lesson, is to step back. Cause you know, whenever an athlete asks me to help them with nutrition, really the first question I have with them is, what training cycle are you in? Where is your training right now? Because that will help me understand their energy demands. And then we get into the goals and weight loss goals, body composition goals, performance goals, but it's very important to understand what training cycle you're in first.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So basically now we were speaking about things that are more relevant to the phase when you are just increasing mileage or building this endurance and training also your metabolism, right?
Right, exactly.
And as the year progresses, as you are closing up to the season and your activities are going or starting to be more frequent, more intense, then your needs for carbohydrates also increase.
Exactly. Yep. And I think it's important. Yes. We know they increase, and there's, you know, each individual will vary based on their needs. I think it's important for them to look at, you know, from a weekly basis, what their daily workouts look like. You know, are there aerobic days? Are there more anaerobic days? Are there a little bit of both? Are there off days? Because that's where they can start. You know, I don't want your listeners to think, oh, you know, once the season hits, I should eat high carbohydrate all the time. Perhaps if you're training hard all the time, then yes. But if there are recovery days or easier days, those are great days to kind of cycle back down again, simply because you're not going to need that energy because you're not expending that energy, right? So that's probably the more complex, most complex part of this is kind of looking from more of a minute detail oriented standpoint and say, oh yeah, you know, Monday is my rest day. You know, maybe I don't need to eat that much, but then, you know, Tuesday I start ramping it up again in terms of carbohydrates.
Yeah, and definitely this somehow or somewhat leans into like intuitive eating,
exactly.
I would say.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great experiment.
Yeah, and I was actually watching some video and Yeah, and you were speaking about, or you were mentioning also intuitive eating, and this is something that has been of I've been interested in recently. So, yeah, could you give us your take on that?
Yes, absolutely. So
yes,
that's a tricky one because you know, a lot of times we are not clued in with our brain in terms of our energy needs or our nutrition needs. So sometimes we eat out of habit or we eat out of emotion, whereas intuitive eating is really teaching us to kind of take a step back and kind of check our thoughts, check our feelings and say, you know, am I hungry? Like asking the question, am I hungry? But more importantly, why am I eating? You know, am I eating out of hunger or am I eating out of emotion? Am I using food as a reward system or am I using food as a punishment system? Really, at the end of the day, we want to be able to promote a healthy relationship with food by asking the question, you know, why? You know, why am I eating lunch? Oh, because I'm hungry. It's not because I'm stressed out at work. It's not because, you know, it's 12 o'clock and I have to eat. It's really kind of cluing in more with the body's, you know, systems and from a psychological standpoint and really knowing the why or asking the question, the why behind it. So intuitive eating is, you know, we're born with intuitive eating skills as babies, but through the environment, we are shaped differently. And certain people are shaped differently, certainly depending on what part of the world you come from or what type of family structure in terms of the food, with the way food is portrayed. But at the end of the day, we really have to ask the question, you know, do I have a healthy relationship with food? And it takes years to develop that, to be honest with you. And it's really just kind of getting away from the, you know, what I call diet handcuffs, you know, getting away from the reward system of food and really getting back down to the biological nature of, am I eating because I'm actually hungry or not?
Yeah, definitely. It's like a very broad topic, I would say. We could talk about it a lot because there are so many things that affect, like how you feel, and how you eat, right?
Exactly.
From exercise through the sociological factors and so on.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, and well, actually, now the off season is a good thing to experiment with that.
It's true. Yeah, actually, that's a great point. I mean, it's a great time just to play with your different macronutrients because as you control your blood sugar better or worse, you will have different psychological consequences, right? So if you're controlling your blood sugar really well, you're going to stay fuller longer. You'll most likely be your mood will be better depending on what's going on in your life, obviously. But you know, if you make some mistakes or don't control your blood sugar as well, or eat a little bit more of one nutrient versus the other and not control blood sugar, optimize it, that's when you're going to find yourself rewarding yourself with food or going to those comfort foods, we call them, which are usually sweet foods for most people, not all people, but that's where the reward system kind of comes into play. But yeah, I mean, in the off season, if you can look at a good 4 to 8 weeks of a little bit of experimentation, and you know, what's really helpful is actually to keep a food journal and not the food log like people are used to when you're quantifying, but keep a food journal and, you know, just jot down, you know, when you eat breakfast, lunch, or dinner, you know, jot down your feelings. I know that sounds really weird, but that actually helps you kind of clue into why you're eating. So, you know, if I'm eating breakfast, well, you know, I woke up hungry, I'm going to eat. But if I'm having a snack and it's midday and I'm not really hungry, I want to write down why I'm eating this, right? So it's a great time of the year to start engaging in that process.
Yeah, that's an excellent advice. Like when you're making any change, I would say you have to track it in some way, and journaling it is an excellent choice.
Absolutely.
Get so many insights.
Yeah. Well, and you can look back at it and you've got a little bit of knowledge, right? So you look back and you're like, oh, wow, I forgot. You know, a lot of people forgot what they had for dinner last night. But if you journal something, you can actually go back and start connecting the dots, right? There's and sometimes, like I find this with some individuals I work with, there's a certain situation. There's always a trigger, right? And it could be a situation. It could be a person. It could be something at work. Something will set off a behavior system, right? So you have a trigger, then you're going to respond to that trigger, and that solution sometimes is food, and sometimes it's not the best choice of food. right? So we kind of want to get to the bottom of what are my triggers, and that's where the journaling comes in very, very handy.
Yeah, definitely. What I found out is also that when you journal these things, it's like we are kind of lazy and don't want to do that.
Yes.
And we think like, yeah, of course, like mentioned, I will remember what I ate, and you know, it's like this is obvious to me. Yeah, maybe right in the moment it is, but when you write it down, you realize actually you look at it from a different perspective and get the insight actually.
Exactly. It's almost like somebody helping you, you know, kind of that outsider looking in, except it's your journal, right? So when you reread it, you almost become that outsider looking in again.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
I actually had a question from my friend Andy, and he was asking about the body weight.
Uh-huh.
And that is like body weight differences during the or different phases of season, like racing weight versus normal weight.
Yes. That's definitely one to be contended. 'Cause there's a lot of people with a lot of different schools of thought. I personally, like, I know athletes who drop their weights, you know, on purpose during season, you know, that quote unquote racing weight to engage in better performance, mm-hmm. right? So we know that happens. What I like to make apparent to individuals is, if you do that, there are psychological consequences, certainly, right? So some people drop weight pretty easy, some people don't. It's the people who don't that I have a big problem with, because the psychological consequences of failing to lose weight are very, very harsh, right? So which means they go back into that intuitive eating cycle and they actually punish themselves through food because they're not satisfying their goal of weight loss. Additionally, if they come out of that, you know, if they're not able to get to racing weight, most likely they're actually going to gain weight because they are, like I said, psychologically punishing themselves again. So I don't really argue if racing weight is viable or not. What I argue is, what are the psychological consequences of going in and out of racing weight? And that's what I deal with as a sport dietitian, and more of the psychology behind it. Whereas, you know, some coaches, like I know some coaches who recommend, yeah, let's get you down to racing weight, but they don't really work with their athletes on the back end after season, when they actually have to get their weight back up to normal weight. Otherwise there some physiological processes won't function properly, like hormone production specifically, right? So that's the only problem I have with racing weight, are just the psychological consequences if one, if not done properly, but two, if approached improperly also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
I don't know if that helps. Yeah. And that's what, you know, with weight loss in general, I think people really need to acknowledge that there are, you know, weight loss is a psychological, there's a huge psychological factor in it. And it's not just about, you know, calories in, calories out. It's not about eating less and all of a sudden I'm 10 pounds lighter. Like, there's a huge psychological component to weight loss. And I don't think a lot of individuals factor that in. Now, that said, I've seen a lot of, I hate to classify this, but a lot of young males who can really go in and out of racing weight pretty easily, right? Because they've got, you know, they've got age on their side. They're probably training a lot to support that. And, you know, maybe they've got the genetics to support going back and forth between racing weight and normal walking weight pretty easily. But, you know, certainly as we age, we know that isn't the case. That ability slows down a little bit. But also it just becomes a little bit harder, because then you have to think about different, you know, when I work with athletes, I think about their life stressors. So once family, you know, family is in there and kids and maybe a little bit stressful or high pressure job, like all of that is going to affect your body's ability to be successful or not, because from a physiological standpoint of losing weight because of hormone changes, and from a psychological standpoint because of the whole reward versus, you know, pleasure mechanism.
Yeah, and thank you for mentioning that, or taking a different kind of look from a different perspective at weight loss, because I believe that it's the most important to look at it from the psychological standpoint, as you mentioned, because yeah, in the end, it's very simple from the physiological standpoint, let's say,
yeah.
Or can be very simplistic,
yes.
But many people, well, we see it, people are still failing diets and having, let's say, a bad relationship with food and going on binge eating and so on. and they don't address their habits and the stress and the other things that have when you make some of these things, they compound. So
oh, absolutely. Yep. Yep. It's really important, I think, for people to understand that.
Yeah, so maybe let's talk about a little bit, like, maybe you can tell us, like, what does your OCR training now looks like? Like, let's say I would say proportion of your aerobic training to OCR specific, or maybe like weight training or strength training.
Yeah. You know, I'm in my off season now, which is kind of nice. But prior to, you know, August, I did a 6 to 8 week training block getting ready for this Ultra Beast. And I was kind of coming off a lower aerobic fitness level. So I probably started the first couple weeks I needed to get more aerobically fit, right? So I spent the first couple weeks really just hitting the trails, doing a lot of aerobic work. So at that point, I would estimate 80% of my training was more aerobic and 20% more anaerobic. And most of the anaerobic was purely body weight, right? Body weight squats, pull-ups, push-ups, and burpees. As I got, you know, as I started to build up my aerobic fitness, and you know this, everyone kind of responds differently at different times to their fitness level improving. Once I knew I started improving just by, you know, by the way I was feeling and my times and my heart rate responses, then I kind of shifted, I would call it more into my quote unquote OCR training. So myself, because I knew this Ultra Beast was a 31-mile race, I knew I still needed a huge aerobic component. So at that point, I shifted. It was probably more of a 50-50 split between aerobic, where all of my aerobic training was done on trails. You know, it was kind of respecting my heart rate, where I would walk or power hike if my heart rate got too high, because I knew the terrain that I was doing this on, because I had done the beast there the previous year. So I knew I had to kind of pace myself and slow it down. And that's when I started adding more, I guess you would call it, you know, OCR training, right? So bucket carries, you know, you've got the bucket at home, I put some rocks in it, walk up and down the street kind of a thing, some tire drag, some tire flipping, you know, just moving, really just moving heavy things, right? Trying to mimic as much as I could, you know, doing some different hanging positions on pull-up bars and pull-up mechanisms. And then, you know, maybe a touch of traditional strength training. And that's just because of my age, right? I'm not a young gun anymore. So I know I need to try to maximize and preserve as much muscle mass as possible. So I would lift traditional weights.
That's an excellent point.
Yeah. So bench press, bicep, shoulder press. So I would throw that in once a week just to do that traditional heavy lifting outside of the traditional OCR obstacle training. And then I kept that up until race day. You know, I kind of made that shift and kind of kept with that shift. And I mean, I've got such a running background. I know that the running will, you know, I dare I say this, but be the easier component for me. it was the obstacles that I knew. So in you know, we all know which obstacles we normally don't have the best luck at. So you know, it came together because that plan, which was a little more structured for me than in previous years. It actually worked, because on the first lap, you know, my biggest achievement was the first lap. I didn't miss any obstacles, which was fantastic, right? And even the spear throw for Spartan, like I've never hit the spear throw before. And then on the second lap, unfortunately, you know, Mother Nature started calling and started dumping some rain on us. So the monkey bars and the twister for Spartan became, that was just more of a, there was no grip. So unfortunately, I failed a couple of those obstacles, but that wasn't due to fitness. That was just due to really just the you know, the bars being wet.
Yeah. I feel for you. Happened the same to me.
Yeah. I know. It's tricky, isn't it? But you know, I've been learning personally, like over the years, where I don't need to put as much time in the aerobic anymore because of my background. Because I've been doing endurance sports for over 20 years, it's very easy for me to train my aerobic system very quickly without getting hurt. So I try to emphasize a little bit more of the OCR training specifically, especially in those last, you know, 4 to 6 weeks before a race.
That's a very important point, because we have our strengths and weaknesses, and a person who is like you who comes from this, let's say, endurance background probably doesn't need as much of running or keeping or focusing on that. You just want to, let's say, maintain it for most of the part and focus on your weakness rather. So how much training actually do you do for maintaining your endurance?
Oh, that, you know, like now in the off season, what
I know this is very personal.
It is. No. Yeah. It's, you know, it kind of goes on how I feel. And I hate to say that, but I love the off season because it's just, you know, I do what I want to do. Like I'll go mountain biking if I feel like mountain biking. I'll go trail running. I'll go hiking, right? Sometimes with a weighted backpack, sometimes not. So right now I try to do something every day for at least an hour. And it's you know, in there also is back to traditional strength training. Right, so I am lifting weights at least, I'd say, 2 to 3 times a week right now. Traditional weightlifting, you know, not spending a lot of time doing it, but maybe 30 minutes a session. But I just, you know, some of it is dictated by the weather. You know, I live in Colorado, and now is one of the most beautiful times of the year to actually be outside because it's just, you know, the colors are changing and it's getting cooler. And like, this is my favorite time to be on the trails. So I tend to spend a little bit more time running and mountain biking now. And then once the snow hits, I'll be indoors a little bit more. And that's when I start to focus maybe a little bit more on weight training, do some indoor cycling. But like I said, about, you know, 6-7 days a week, at least an hour a day, if not, you know, a couple hours a day, depending.
Yeah, I think that's also good for your mind to switch this, like running for biking and
absolutely. Exactly. Yeah. The occasional swim, you know, I am a triathlete. I haven't swam, you know, in a few months, but you know, swimming is just, it's so therapeutic sometimes, especially if you don't have time goals. And it's such a great exercise to improve not only cardiovascular fitness, but also some specific muscular strength also.
Yeah, actually you got me thinking now because I had some running injury last year during December, January, and I spend most of the time swimming, actually.
Oh yeah, exactly. You know, and a lot of runners actually use swimming. They're not good swimmers, but they use swimming as a great cross training tool because of either injury or they just don't want to get overtrained in running.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. But of course, we always try to keep busy, no matter what, right?
Right. Yeah. Depends on the person. But I also like the point that you brought across that was like you are just enjoying it now this off time, which is very necessary to recover and just go by your feeling to some extent.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I really envy people.
Go ahead.
Hey, go on.
Yeah. I was going to say it's good because, you know, during the year we get so focused on training and not only is this a great time for a physical break, but also just a mental break, right? And that's the great thing is just to say, wow, I don't have to do whatever it is. I want to just go do what I want to do today. And maybe it's not running. Maybe it's not cycling. Maybe it's just going for a nice hike, right?
Yeah, and you can also bring somebody who doesn't run or who doesn't have the same fitness level for a hike.
Exactly. Yeah, that's even better. And then it makes it more enjoyable.
Yeah, definitely.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, Bob. So thank you very much for your time. I don't have
Oh, it's my pleasure. This has been awesome.
Okay. I don't have any more questions and I want to be respectful also of your time.
Oh yeah, thank you. Yeah, well, you let me know when you post this, and I'll post across my social media network also, and you know, help promote this.
Thank you. I will be posting it probably like next week, during the next week, like starting Monday, Tuesday.
Yep.
And before we finish, let's say people who would like to maybe connect with you or find out more about your training or what you can do for them, what you can help them with. So where can they find you?
Yeah, I'm pretty easy to find. If you can obviously Google me, but my last name is sometimes a stickler for people. But if I can be easily found at my, we've got a few websites, but my business website, Energy Performance, ENRGperformance.com. Also, I'm very good on email. If any of your listeners have any questions or they want to reach out, you can reach me at bob@energyenrgperformance.com. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, that's probably the easiest way to get a hold of me and find all my resources. I've got quite a few books on the market, and easy to get a hold of some of my resources out there for sure.
And do you do also the testing for metabolic efficiency?
I sure do. Yes, I've got two facilities here in Colorado that I do it at, and just actually did one this morning on a Ironman athlete that flew in from Atlanta, Georgia.
Okay, perfect. And actually, even better, because Colorado, as I know, is very popular for athletes.
It sure is. Yes, yes. We are definitely not shy for any type of athlete, really.
Okay, Bob, thank you very much for your time once again.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I appreciate the opportunity and your time for sure.
Yeah.
Hey, guys, I hope you enjoyed the episode and see you next time. If you liked it, please share, subscribe, and you will find all the important links in the show notes or below video, however you got to this. So there will be also a page to subscribe, my Facebook page, my website, and if you are looking for a coach or coaching experience, you are looking to boost your performance, whether it's mental or physical, to the next level, then go to my website that is linked down below and contact me through there.